Welcome to another episode of Let's Take a Journey. If you listened to our last episode, kind of left off on a cliffhanger. Of course, I brought my guest back, my grandfather, Ricardo Valadez. If you didn't listen to the last episode, talking mostly about his early life, super interesting if you want to catch up to at least where we're going to talk from here on out. So we'll continue on basically after he got out of the military back to Colorado here. So first and foremost, Ricardo Valadez, welcome, Gramps. How are you doing today?
Thank you. Doing okay. Glad to be alive for one more day. One more day above the dirt.
So you got out of the military, you said your 3 years, so probably about 20-ish, around 2021 when you got out. At what point or when did you decide to grow your mustache?
As soon as I got out of the military, I grew my mustache. And I've never had it off since.
As soon as you got out of the military, you decided to grow your mustache? Because I don't think anyone in my family at least has that physically seen you at least in person without a mustache. We have pictures of it, but I don't think anyone has seen you without one.
Nope, nobody has. And even when I had my cancer, I was lucky enough not to lose it.
Getting out of the military, you're 20 years old. We kind of talked about it. You do a lot of different jobs, or at least a couple different jobs.
Let me correct you a little bit. I got out on December 13th of 1960, which I was still 19, and my birthday was the 23rd of December, is when I turned 20.
What was your next step after that? What do you do when you get back? Because first off, you're coming back from Carolina in the middle of the winter.
Well, first thing I done was try to find a job, and one of the first jobs I had was I was an orderly at St. Joseph's Hospital, and they referred to us as bedpan commandos. And I did have my own responsibilities, same as the nurse's aides. I had to do baths and give enemas, and except the only different thing I had to do was take care of the patients that expired. I'd have to take them down to the morgue and put them in a slab and tag their toes and put a block under their neck. And I had a partner there, was a black guy, and he would pay me extra or do extra duties of mine so he wouldn't have to deal with the dead people. So I kind of made out there. I didn't have a problem. The only problem was when you're trying to find an empty drawer to put them in, you never know what kind of facial expressions they're going to have when you open the drawer and there's a cadaver in there.
How long did you end up doing this for, and how did you get into doing this?
Well, like I say, I was just looking for a job, and this was one of the want ads in the paper. And after I started doing that, I would work from 7 to 3:30. And then I got on at the post office as a mail handler. I would go there from 5 to 1 in the morning.
What was your mom's first thoughts of you coming back home? Was she happy to have you back?
Well, yeah, she always had a big emotional breakdown when I used to come home and visit and then have to leave her. But she was glad to have me back. And at that time, we were living in the projects over on 24th and Arapaho, I think.
I guess I didn't ask this the last episode. Did you ever worry about your mom when you were away? Was that a thought you ever had?
Of course I always worried about her. She was already a senior. She was in her 70s already, I think. And there was people around, the friends that I knew would look out for her, and then my sister would kind of check on her.
Your mom, as we kind of talked about, she's very well-versed and could get into any place that she really wanted to and kind of she took care of herself very, very well.
She had street smarts. She never had no education, but she knew how to get around. And like I say, when we were working the fields and stuff, they didn't have no GPS. They just, I don't know how they would find their way to go to California and Nebraska, Oregon. And that always find their way. They'd say there's a compadre or somebody working this one crop over here, and they'd get in the old Model A and go find them, and they would find them. How they did that, I don't know.
At what age did you meet my grandmother?
I was 21, I think. We were having a get-together for my birthday at a friend of mine's bar. His name was Bibbs Solano. His dad owned the place, Patrick Solano, on Larmer Street, 2219 Larmer. And a bunch of us used to go down there all the time. And I ran into your grandmother about that time. They used to play ball on Saturdays or Sundays, I don't remember which, but I went there a couple of times, and then we got together for beers afterwards, and we started talking, getting along. So that was the meeting.
How'd you come across Bibbs? Was he a friend that you knew from back or then, back when you, before you left, or was he someone that you met coming back?
No, I knew Bibbs before we went. We used to go to school together at Manuel, and I wasn't aware that his folks had the bar until after I got back. But anyway, we were celebrating my birthday, and they asked me, "Well, how old are you?" I says, 21. He says, "Damn it, you've been coming in here for 2 years." I said, "Well, it ain't my fault. You'd never ask for an ID."
Yeah, times were probably a little bit different back then, particularly probably in a family-owned bar. So you meet my grandmother at 21. Do you remember what your first impression of her was?
Well, she had nice legs, that's for sure. And at that time, the old saying was from the 40s that they had nice yams. Why they called them yams, I don't know. But anyway, I spotted her from her feet on up. And she had me then. We managed to like the same things, the same type of music, and we were very compatible.
Do you remember who she was with? Because I assume, at least from what I know about the Solanos and our families, we're all very, at least closely tight-knit, and that was a place that they would go hang out in, like you said, after playing baseball or softball.
She was always with Dolores, and sometimes Lucy would show up, but very rarely. But most of the time it was with Dee. And Bert and her cousin, Mary D.
So let's talk about the 6 months you guys spent dating before you decided to get married. What do you remember of those 6 months, at least together, kind of dating? I know she spent, we'll talk to her probably later on in another podcast, but I know she spent time living here with her cousin, Mary D, and my aunt, D.
Well, one of the reasons she came to Colorado was her mother was in the hospital for 14 years and had tuberculosis, so they finally decided to send her to the National Jewish Hospital here in Denver. So that's when Jenny graduated from high school, she came down here, and then I think one of her cousins came with her or was already here, but her mother was the reason that she came down, and I think she passed away early 60s, right after. I never had the privilege of meeting her because I didn't get out of the service until December. But we used to spend a lot of time going to clubs. I used to love to go to the jazz clubs, and they had Blue Note, they had the Emerson Street East, and they had top billing jazz musicians come there. And at the time, you can smoke. I smoked cigars at that time. And sip on your drinks and listen to music.
When we say club, at least today, it's something completely different than what you guys used to. What was it like to go to a club back then? Like, let's talk about sort of the dress that we're going to. What was the environment like?
You did dress up to the nines when you went. I always wore a vest and a jacket and a suit. And during the winter, carried my top coat on my arm, had a hat. And the ladies, like I say, they went all out to dress up. As you just didn't go in with your Levi's and to hear these musicians play.
Was it just you guys going to these clubs, or was it usually a big group? Because I know, at least for our family, we tend to travel in a pack together.
No, it was, when we went to the jazz clubs, it was usually just her and I. And I don't remember if there was any other couples that went, because we mostly liked the jazz, and most of our other friends and stuff stuck to the Mexican music and the trios and the rock and roll and doo-wop stuff.
What is your most memorable experience, at least going to these jazz clubs with my grandmother, maybe like an artist that you remember, or...
Well, the major artist that we never failed to go see was Lou Rawls. I was always making it a point for our anniversary or something like that to take her to see Lou Rawls, because we both loved him. That was a special evening for us.
At what point or what made you decide that she is the one and that you are going to marry her?
I have no idea. I keep telling my wife that they put a hoax on me, and in Spanish they call it membrujo, which means that they put a spell on you. Her little grandma probably made me some ground skeleton powder in my drinks or something. But next thing I know, I'm asking her. I didn't ask her to marry me. I said, what would you do if I asked you? So I keep telling her, legally or officially, I never said, will you marry me? But anyway, that's the way it was. Next thing I know, we're at the altar at the Sacred Heart Church.
At what point did you meet the family of that?
Well, we kind of kept to the old Mexican tradition. We had the family over with my mother and I for a dinner, and she brought her dad and her sisters. When they came over, we ate, and then I went through the routine of asking her father for her hand in marriage.
When did you meet the rest of the family?
Dating, I did go to their house, and I met Lucy and Dee, and a short time after, her brother John came in and her sister Marie, and they were both still in high school. So they went to school here and graduated here. But we met the whole family that way.
Was it the family, I guess, back then, was it always very similar to how I know it? For a big event, you always bring kind of everyone's coming together for the holidays. Did you get to participate in those before you guys actually got married? I know it was probably 6 months, but maybe sometime in between.
No, we didn't have any big family get-togethers that I'm aware of. They might have had something on their own, but we didn't start doing all that until after everybody got married and we had kids and stuff. So Bibbs and Dolores got married, and they were from Solano's Bar, and we had five couples get married that used to patronize Solano's Bar. And most of them are either dead now or still married to each other.
Do you remember at least some of the family's first impression of you?
Yeah, most of it negative. They said, what are you marrying that bum for, you know? But anyway, I said, I'm going to marry her, and I keep teasing them that we're going on our 63rd wedding anniversary in June, and I tell them that I just stay with her so I can make Lucy mad, but in reality, I don't know what I'd do without her.
So let's talk a little bit. So what do you remember, at least the days leading up to your wedding for the most part, or in the wedding day itself?
Well, we had a run around, Jenny running around getting her dress and the bridesmaids, and then we had to get the band, and my best man, Bob Reese, he had contracted Phil Trujillo and his band, which was a big local band. And little did we know, getting closer to the wedding date, I asked my best man, I says, Bob, you better check on the band, because I got a funny feeling. So he checked on them, and sure enough, he didn't intend to play and hadn't notified us. So there we are, probably a week and a half, 2 weeks away from the wedding, looking for another band. And we made out pretty good. There was this group, I can't remember the name. I should be able to remember the name, but after 60-something years, they were a good group, and they played everything that we wanted, plus Mexican music and regular pop music and jitterbug. So they were very good, and I was kind of glad that Phil Trujillo didn't show up.
Would you say your wedding was, I guess, a classical Mexican wedding? By that, I mean, like, everyone's pitching in for food and kind of bringing all the things we need for this big gathering together.
Well, my mom and some of her friends done most of the cooking, and on the other side, they helped with Jenny's preparations and taking care of the out-of-town people. But it was a big wedding. We had seven couples, I think. We had a wedding breakfast, we had a reception, and we had the dinner. So it was pretty good. For the reception, we had an accordion, a norteño group that played, and then for the dance, we had the group that we had selected. We had a good time by everybody, but there was a few grouchy faces from Nebraska. They couldn't find the place, and it was too far. And so, but other than that, 90% of the people had a good time.
Did you guys honeymoon at all, or was that a thing back then? Because I know from both of you guys came from very low-income situations.
We had sort of a honeymoon, because on Labor Day weekend, which was usually a long weekend, it was a custom. A lot of people from Denver would go down to Juarez and go to the bullfights and go around to the different clubs. And we went down there, and we had a good time. Except on our way back, we had just bought a brand-new Renault. And on our way back, we left the motel heading home, and we had forgotten my watch and stuff, so we turned around and went back. And then coming back, I think I was trying to make up the time, and we rolled the car. We flipped and rolled three times, and we just landed at the edge of a big canyon that we would have been dead meat if we would have gone over. Anyway, it was close to Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. I got a ticket for speeding because the highway patrolman figured out the mileage and then the time-wise, and he figured that I was going a little over the speed limit. So he gave us a ride into Truth or Consequences, and we were kind of low on funds, so we called over to Solano's Bar, and the whole group, they got together some funds and sent us money to get back home. So that was more or less the closest thing to a honeymoon we had.
How would you send money back then? Because for me, when I say that, I just hop on an app and I can send my money to my friends or whoever. What was the process of doing that?
They had to go to a Western Union office and send it under a person's name. And then we had to receive it at another Western Union office. And then we'd have to go cash it.
What was the first place that you guys lived in together?
The first place was, trying to think. Oh, yeah, I remember. It was one of the apartments off of Grant Street. And we moved in there. And the first thing we saw was cockroaches. So we had to move out. And we found this nice apartment called the Frank Apartments on Grant Street, right off of 17th Street, which was close to where Jenny worked, because she used to work at the State Services Building, which was on 15th and Sherman. One of the things we bought at this one Mexican store on Larmer, Ponce Furniture, they had an advertisement if you bought a stereo set that they would give you 20 albums. So we went over there and we bought the stereo set. Then they tried to pawn off some off-brand albums, and I said, no, I want the RCAs. And they had the big top Mexican singers. So they gave me the 20 albums, and that's what we used to do a lot at the apartment, listen to the music.
Denver's still probably not very big at this time still, so I assume you guys are still close to the inner city itself.
Yes.
How long did you guys stay in that apartment?
We stayed there a few years, and then I'm trying to think if we rented a place on 39th and LePan in North Denver, and they were duplexes. Some two duplexes facing the other duplexes. We lived in one, and Bibbs and Dolores lived in another one across the hall, across the yard from us. And from there, we bought our first house, which was on 34th and Osage, and it used to belong to the Longos. The Longos was an Italian family that owned the Subway Tavern on 38th and LePan. All the Longo family, the boys and the girls, were born there at that house that we purchased. And it was right across the street from a little Italian restaurant that was very popular called Little Pepinas.
As things do happen, like you talked about, my Uncle Bibbs and Aunt Dee got married first out of that group. So naturally...
No, they got married after we did.
They got married after you guys did. Okay. After you guys did... but they are the first ones to have the first baby out of that whole group, besides, I'm disincluding my cousin George here, who's born well before this, of course. So a baby Solano that you guys have had many babies run through your house of different last names and names and from different all sorts of different families. What do you remember of the first baby of, I guess, your guys' group?
Well, that was Stefan Solano, D and Bibbs' son. He came between me and Jenny, because when we brought him over to babysit, she'd put him right in the middle of the bed, and I had to behave myself. But he was a pleasure to look after, and we always had them with us, you know. Wherever we went, usually Stefan and... I'm getting ahead of myself, but usually Stefan was with us.
Yeah, I mean, not too far ahead of yourself, because a couple years later, you guys have your first child, who is my father. Do you remember sort of at least what it felt like to be rushing my grandmother to the hospital to birth your son?
Yeah, we had to go to Mercy Hospital. One of the things I told her, I said, don't come home if it's not a boy. Of course, I was kidding. That was when we had, she was in pretty hard labor there for maybe 14 hours, I think. I might be exaggerating, but around that length of time. And at that time, my sister Lucy used to work at Mercy, so she was able to check in on them. And it so happened, coincidentally, one of the girls I went to high school with, Juanita Roybal, she had the babies at the same time Rick was born, except she had twins. And like I say, it was a coincidence, because I hadn't seen her since we got out of high school.
When is the first time that you got to see the baby? Did you hold my father right after he was born, or?
No, I was there after they cleaned him up, put him in the nursery there, I came back and they brought the baby to Jenny. I was able to hold him at that time. And then my mother was there. She gave him a little blessing.
Not long after he was born, of course, my aunt comes. But what was your guys' first year of living together, living with the baby? And then I assume, of course, my Nino Stefan is coming in and out as you guys babysit when Bibbs and Dee go out.
It was a whole new experience, because I had to learn to change diapers. And at that time, we didn't have disposable diapers. We had to have cloth diapers, and it was pretty stinky. You had to put them in a bucket with some bleach and stuff. But at one time, we hired a diaper service, so that wasn't too bad, being both of us was working. Jenny didn't get back to work for a while, and then we had to find a babysitter for Rick. And I'm trying to think who used to take care of him. first I'm trying to think that it was Bibbs's sister, Josie Solano. She's the one who took care of him for a while. And then we moved from 34th and Osage and bought a house on 1st and Winona Court. And at first I was turned down for the loan, and I was at work moping around, and my group leader asked me, "So what's the matter with you? What's the problem?" I said, "Well, we tried for a house and we got turned down." And he says, "Well, give me the application form and let me talk to somebody at personnel." So he did, and sure enough, he got it. So my wages showed that they didn't put down the overtime and all that stuff, but with the overtime and Sunday premium pay and all that, we were able to qualify. Then we were worried about making a payment of $126 a month. I said I'd give my left arm for $126 a month now.
Did you guys move into the First and Winona house just as my father was a baby before my Aunt Becky was born, or after my Aunt Becky was born?
After Becky was born. But they were still toddlers when we moved over there. Little did I know, one of the other mail handlers, I moved next door to him. His name was Paul Chavez, and he had girls. And we ended up being compadres because I baptized his son. And then up the street was Storm and Norman, Norm Silva. He lived up the street, and he worked for the post office. Had a guy across the street, Mr. Bloom. He worked for the post office. So we had a post office neighborhood.
Before we kind of jump into the First in Winona adventures, what was your first initial impression? Were you worried? Were you scared? Or was this something you were excited to do? And at least for people of your generation, is it a little bit expected to be a father and all that?
Well, they expected you to just go to it like a duck to water, but that's not the way it worked. We had some scares when they'd get sick and they'd get a fever and go into convulsions and stuff. And we kind of panic a little bit, but, you know, we always had somebody to call and get advice from. And usually we'd know when it was the time to take them into emergency or when we had to do something that we can do to relieve his pain or his crying. So it was a learning experience. So it was a lot easier when we had our daughter, Rebecca.
That was going to be sort of my next question. One child, one baby is probably hard, at least to start off, but you guys have almost two, little more than a year apart. Juggling that, just kind of two babies need a lot of attention. How did that work out for you guys?
Well, at least we had one for each of us, so we can take care of one while the other one was taking care of the other, or vice versa. We got to taking them out to restaurants and stuff when they were toddlers still, and they learned to behave pretty good in the restaurants. And we were always complimented on their behavior from other patrons in the restaurants.
So kind of mixing in with family, of course, as my father is born, the Solanos have another child as well, Chris, who's about the same age as him. You have a kind of all these mix of babies kind of running around. You and the Solanos are very much intertwined, and I guess we still are today with how our families just kind of intermingle. Do you remember much of that, particularly as they're kids, before you move into that Winona house with my Nino, Stefan, Chris, my dad, and of course my Aunt Becky?
When we moved over to Winona Court, we all had kids about the same age, and they all got together, and we all got together. And each one of us had some kind of participation in our neighbor's children. We were all compadres, which that's godfathers to one or two of the kids of each of the families. So we were all close knit neighbors. We were more than neighbors. We were friends instead of neighbors. We were, like my little sign says, we were neighbors by accident, but friends by choice. we've done a lot of things together as kids growing up with each other. But Stefan and Chris Solano were, they used to spend most of the weekends with us. They hated to go home. We had to chase them home.
Yeah, I would emphasize you guys are probably, at least for that Winona court group, as you will so become known as, you guys are probably a little bit more than neighbors. You guys were almost family.
Yeah, we were.
For most of you guys, the Ayalas, the Chavezes, the Guerreros, of course the Valadezes who are on that block, and the Solanos by proximity as well. The way you guys just interacted, it was kind of like you were going to the right place at the right time for what you all needed and to have a life that I don't think a lot of people have the opportunity to get to live, especially now in this time.
No, there would never be a group of people like we call them the Winona Court Gang, and some people call it the Wino Court Gang. We all grew up, the kids grew up together, and they become friends, and they, to this day, they still keep in touch. They've been threatening to get a reunion of some of the kids. Well, they're not the kids. They're all grown up and have kids of their own, but we were more family than we were neighbors, and Chris and Stefan grew up with them at the same time, being they were with us so often.
We could probably spend a whole episode just talking about the Winona Court Gang and just your stories. How long did you guys end up living there?
Probably 16 years. For some reason, your grandmother decided she wanted to move. So one day I came home from work and they said, well, we sold the house. I said, what do you mean you sold the house? So then we found a condo over further south, over by Fort Logan, off of Union and Lowell. And we bought a condo there where we stayed probably 3 years at least. And we didn't like it. They had a swimming pool and everything, but at that time they were kind of prejudiced, I think, because nobody'd be using the pool, and we'd had the kids over and all that. And then they'd come and tell us that we're only allowed so many kids or so many people in the pool. And like I say, nobody was using it, but we had to adhere to their rules and regulations because it was a homeowner's thing. So then we looked for a home, and that's when we moved over to 5060 South Meade Street, and we were there for the last 45 years, I think.
What were your best experiences in that 16 years at Winona Court? I mean, I think they're probably, I would probably say the golden years of your guys' life. You guys are young still. You have your kids roaming around. You have your best friends living literally right across the street from you.
Well, we had a lot of activities. We had the kids. All the kids were in some kind of sports, so we spent a lot of time going to and from parks and at one time, Becky got into soccer and Rick was playing football, so we had to split and go to different parks. But we'd go with the kids on Halloween. One time, the kids from the neighborhood, they made a haunted house in our yard, and they charged people to get in, and they were doing stuff like they'd make them blindfold them, and they peeled grapes, and they made them feel like eyeballs. And the kids that had to stick their hand in there, and then they made spaghetti and thinking they were worms, and hung a lot of string down thinking they were spider webs. So we had stuff like that, but all the dads would go with the kids on Halloween, and we'd stop at the other neighbors' homes, and they'd invite us all for a drink. And by the time we were getting around, we had lost the kids. The kids went by themselves, and the dads came home staggering down the hill.
Tell me about the infamous Winona Court volleyball and pig roast days.
We used to play volleyball, and we'd go down to Sloan's Lake, and we put our volleyball net underneath the lights, the street lights they had there, And we'd play till 12:30, 1 o'clock at night. And naturally, we always had some beers around. And the kids would either play or fall asleep on the park bench or on the blankets. The other thing we done is we weren't very athletic, but we had some friends that they were religiously playing softball players, and they would play 2-3 times a week. So one day we were at a party, and they were there, and they say they're bragging on their softball. So we went on the court, challenged them to a game. Believe it or not, we beat them. We had Polo was pitching, I was catching, and boy, he was firing that ball in there, and I ended up getting a blister. Of course, I didn't know how to catch properly, but anyway, we beat them, and they owed us a keg of beer, and they weren't good losers.
I assume around this time is sort of when our original 4th of July tradition starts to happen, where our family gets together, play softball, and they end up over your guys' house. Would that be true?
Yeah, well, not everybody from Winona Court. The Ayalas would come over, and naturally we had the Solanos, and we had John and his family, and George, and he had his boys, and we'd go play ball, and it was the nieces and nephews against the aunts and uncles, and we had Grandpa. Jenny's dad was in his 70s, and the parents would play against the young kids, and then they would get mad because they didn't play as hard as they're used to. So after we played, they'd have a game by themselves, and then they'd come over, and everybody would contribute with meat and potato salads and beans, and either me or somebody else would do the barbecuing, and it went on for... We had games and stuff to play for the adults, and it was very entertaining. Had a good time, a lot of good memories.
Talked a little bit about the family culture you guys built down on Winona Court. Let's talk about some of your Pueblo trips with the Ayalas. How did you guys end up getting tagged along to go to these?
We invited the Ayalas to Marianne and Tim's wedding, and that was the first time we'd been out together. And we found out they're pretty damn good dancers, boy. So we start going out together. And then when they'd have a party in Pueblo, they'd invite us, and we'd go down there. And that's when we met the Romeros, the Salas, the other Salas family, and the Ayalas. So we went quite frequently down there and made a lot of friends down there.
Where would you guys stay when you guys were down there?
A lot of times we'd stay with Helen's mom, and then most of the time we'd get a hotel room, but they'd pick us up right away, and then we'd go the next day. Helen's mom always made menudo for... If we had a golf tournament, we usually went out afterwards, had a big banquet. The next day she always had menudo ready for us, and that was the best day of it because she made the best menudo. Matter of fact, she made the statement that this man's going to get sick, he's eating so much. But it was so good that you couldn't quit eating it.
What was your best trip down to Pueblo? I know you guys would probably go for a lot of parties, but I would assume some of your trips down there were for musical events. Like you said, you guys... Of course, love to dance, you guys being you and my grandmother, and of course the Ayalas love to dance, as you said about.
They had a street called Lake Street in Pueblo. They had some bars down there, and they had bands in most of the bars, and all the bands were pretty good. We had an annual golf tournament in Pueblo that we had a banquet, and we had the golf tournament, and then we had the presentations of trophies and stuff, and after that we'd go bar hopping, and We mainly stayed at this one bar called Gonzalez's Bar because they had one of the best groups. And we stayed there until they closed and went and danced all night. And then after that, we went, found a place to have menudo.
I assume all this is sort of happening while you're still on Wynonna Court. Would that be correct?
Yes. All that did happen before we moved over to Mead Street.
What would the kids be? The kids are always so close together. And, of course, I've heard stories of you dropping off my dad and my aunt over your sisters and brother-in-laws.
Yeah, my sister, we call them Nino and Nina because they were Rick's godparents. But the whole family just started calling them Nino and Nina. But that's where we used to take our kids. And going to the Bronco games, we'd take them and drop them off. That's where they used to take care of our kids for us.
While you say our family may not be athletic or have some of those things, we are very tied into sports. So we can kind of move our way down the neighborhood and talk a little bit about your guys' adventures at the Bronco games. And, of course, you have Hall of Fame superfan Stormer Norman down the street from you guys. What do you remember about your time, at least with the family and all these other people, going to the Bronco games?
The Phipps brothers owned the Broncos at that time in 1960, and they were trying to generate some attendance, so they were given interest-free loans at one of the banks. So Marie and I went down there, and we got about a lot of 15 seats. And at that time, we were paying $5 a game. It was $150 for the season. So we still had to finance them, and we had to pay them off before the season started. And that was with no interest. So that's when we started going. At that time, they let you take your beer in if you had it in a container. You couldn't take cans or bottles in. We'd always smuggle in a bottle of tequila because we'd have shots every time they had a touchdown. And we were like the Rockies at that time. We didn't have too many touchdowns. But sometimes we'd make an excuse. If we got a field goal, we'd send the bottle down and everybody had a shot. And then we had to holler at them to send the bottles back because it kind of got stuck at the end of the row over there.
You guys went for quite a few years, at least as a big old group together. Some good memories going to the game, maybe some memorable games that you guys remember seeing there. And this is at before we have sort of our brand new stadium here. We still are in our first stadium.
Yeah, we started at Mile High Stadium. It was 35,000 seating capacity. And at that time, if they wanted to merge with, we were the AFL, and if they wanted to merge with the NFL, you had to have a seating capacity of 55,000. They put that bond up for election to see if the people in Denver wanted the stadium. They'd have to vote for that, and they would put up the bonds for the stadium. But it was turned down. They were saying if Denver didn't get an expansion, that they were going to move the team. They were talking about moving to Arizona or something. So all the fans started having fundraisers, and we raised $1.8 million to buy the property, and we turned that over to the city, and with that they built the expansion and built the expansion to 55,000. And that's when we merged with the NFL.
And I've heard you tell stories of this stadium. It's a very interesting construction for back then, because when we talk about the Broncos and going to the game, some of your favorite things was when things were getting loud and rowdy, you could feel the stadium shift.
Yeah, you can. And we used to meet at the park. We call that tailgating. They do fancy tailgating now. But we'd meet at the park, have a couple of beers, and talk about the game. So that was one of the things that we used to do. And one time, Lucy had her carry-on She had it full of bottles and cans. And we were going through the check-in, and the usher asked her, "You have bottles, any bottles or cans?" And she said, "Yeah, yeah, bottles and cans." So they made her step over, and they were gonna, she was gonna throw it out. I said, "No, no, no, wait a minute." So I had my big container, and I poured all the beer in there, and they let us take it in. But she wouldn't have lasted long if she had been captured, because right away she said, "Yeah, I got bottles and cans, bottles." Everybody laughed at that.
I'd say you guys are pretty diehard at that time for the Broncos. Granted, we were pretty terrible up to some point, but eventually you guys get to go to the playoffs and even a Super Bowl somewhere down the road. What do you remember of those times of not only were the Broncos terrible and you guys would still have fun, but when we end up being pretty good and going places, what was that like?
Well, one thing that we weren't able to do now and we were able to do then is when the Broncos came home from an away game, we'd all go to the Stapleton Airport, and we were able to get up close and see them when they got off the plane, and a lot of them were given autographs and stuff. And we do that all the time, whether it was blizzard or not, we'd go meet the Broncos. And one time we were sitting at the stadium, and these people above us had box seats, and they were getting upset and they were kicking the plexiglass, and the retainers that were holding the plexiglass came down and hit me on the head. I had a soft Ben Hogan type hat on. I got cut and I had blood running down my face and all that. So we didn't know that Jenny got hurt. The piece of metal fell, bounced and hit her in the leg. So when they came and took me, and somebody said, "Look at her leg," and it got swollen. She had a blood clot. So they forgot about me, told me, "Hold my hand on my head," and they took her up. We both went, and they took her in the ambulance. We ended up, we weren't too smart, or we would have ended up with season tickets for life, but we got a few $100.
What do you remember of at least the Broncos' first trip to the Super Bowl? Because I imagine for you guys at this time, when you guys are very much active, not only with your neighbors, but with the family, having a bunch of this good times, I assume that's going to end up in a good time together.
One of the things I forgot to mention is we got to see the first black quarterback, Marvin Briscoe. They called him Marvin the Magician. He looked like a water bug. Then when they were trying to get him, he'd be all over the place. But he can throw that ball. They wouldn't sign him. They traded him to the New England Patriots. At that time, they wouldn't make him a quarterback because at that time there were no black quarterbacks. So they made him a wide receiver, and he ended up going to the Super Bowl and getting a ring. I think the first year we went in 77, 76, 77, we were a wild card. We had to go on the road. And one of the biggest games was Pittsburgh and the Iron Curtain. And they had the terrible towels. And we beat them at home, at their home field. And then for the playoffs, for the final playoffs to go to the Super Bowl, we had to play Pittsburgh again. But this time we played them at home, and we beat them. And I made the mistake of telling Rebecca that if we won, I'm taking her to the Super Bowl with us. Sure enough, we won, and everybody went crazy. They went down on the field. Rebecca wanted to go. I said, "No, we ain't going down there." And we stood up there by our seats and just watched the celebration. They tore down the goalposts and everything. That's when the Super Bowl XIII was in New Orleans.
Did you guys end up going to New Orleans?
Yes, I was picked. Several of us were picked in the lottery for Super Bowl tickets. The tickets at that time were $35, and the scalping tickets were running about $50 compared to now. we made the trip. There was Super Silva, and there's my brother Tom Rodriguez, Georgia Ramirez, our nephew, and one of our friends called Peter Laurie. His name was David Gonzalez, but they call him Peter Laurie because he looked like Peter Laurie, and myself, and we went in Norm's van. We didn't have no place to stay, but it was a memorable trip.
So you guys just drove down there in Norm's van all together?
Yeah, and we hit an ice storm in Texas, which was the scariest thing I've ever seen. Couldn't go more than 5-10 miles an hour. And then we run across in Denton, Texas. We run across this place that sold the processed meat and sold beef jerky. The best beef jerky I've ever tasted. And getting down there, we stayed in Baton Rouge, and this motel was freezing. It was cold. And we got up early and made it into New Orleans. So we drove straight to the hotel where the Broncos were, and they were coming out. We drove to the stadium where they were having their practice, and they were coming out of the locker rooms, and we started hollering at them and said, "Hey, come on, we'll take you to your hotel." And we got four of them in the car, Reuben Carter and Rick Upchurch, Haven Moses, and one other one that I can't remember right now, Dennis somebody. Anyway, we took them to their hotel, and we were running on empty almost, but we were lucky to make it, and they gave us autographs and stuff. But it was a wild, wild trip.
What do you remember of the actual game that probably happened there?
The game we remember, it was closer than the score was, because they took a touchdown away from us, and we were saying that everybody was saying they paid them off. But we'd have been in the ball game if they wouldn't have taken that touchdown away. And they wouldn't let Norm wear his space-looking Bronco outfit, because they only allow masks during the Mardi Gras, so he had to take it off. He still had a lot of attention.
How long did it take you guys to get down there? Do you remember?
I think it was 2 days. We drove about 12, 14 hours each day. And it took us longer due to the ice storm. But coming back, we took a little longer because we got back about 2 days late.
But I'd say the trip back home was probably a little bit more somber and sad. Had to lick some wounds.
We'd buy souvenirs and stuff during the day. We're drinking and stuff. And we'd say, "Damn it, I bought a mug. I don't know what happened to it." And Norm does not drink. So he'd say, "Well, I got them all, and I put them in the van so everything was safe." So one night we had to sleep in the van, and we're laying there, and then we see these guys with a flashlight going around the windows. They didn't know somebody was in the van. They were getting ready to break in. But then Norm flashed the flashlight back on them, so they took off. And that was the first time that I got to taste raw oysters. We went to this place supposed to be popular for them called Frank's, and they gave us some raw oysters, and we were cutting them with forks and stuff. "You're not supposed to do that," they told me. I said, "Well, these are our oysters. We can do what we want." But then we learned how to do it properly, and they were pretty good. I wasn't too impressed at that time. It wasn't until a few years later on that I really got hung up on raw oysters.
What was it like, at least for you, coming home knowing grandmother had sold this house that you guys just spent the last 16 years in? You're right next door to your guys' best friends. What do you remember feeling about that situation?
Well, like I said, I was surprised. Nothing I could do already because it's already sold. I think she sold it to our neighbor's daughter. It just didn't work out well for her because all the years we lived there, and we were at the bottom of the hill, and all the rains and flash floods and everything we had, we never got water in the basement. But the year we moved out and the owners moved in, they had a flash flood, and the basement got flooded with mud and all that stuff, so I couldn't understand it. Eventually, they moved the house because it was in a floodplain zone. They moved our house and the house across street. I don't know where they moved them to.
What was it like for moving day for you guys? Because like we talked about, moving out of this place is not like moving from house to house, because for you guys, you have a big piece of your community here. Like we talked about, the neighbors, and you guys are neighbors by accident, but friends by choice, more like family by choice. I assume it's probably an emotional time for you guys for those last days.
Yeah, it was. Luckily, we had a lot of help moving, and then we did hire some movers, but we had a lot of help from our friends and the family at that time. So it was kind of sad leaving Winona Court.
For you guys, the your friends would still be a part of your lives from going on, because, of course, we still end up over the Ayals from time to time and see the Chavezes and occasionally the Guerreros. What do you think, at least, that whole experience of moving in there, finding some of your best friends for your lifetime there, means to you now that you're here?
Well, like you say, we're more like family than just friends and neighbors. We've lost a few of them. We've lost Fabian and Sally Guerrero and Polo Ayala. And there was a few more, Rusty and some of the people that we sang in the mariachi group at Guadalupe. Most of them are gone already. Our wedding party, we have very few. There's probably about five of us left out of our wedding party.
Like I've said, you've lived a pretty long life, and I've heard you say multiple times, it was never really your intent to make it this far. For you, at least those sort of early fatherhood years, basically those 60s, 70s, and sort of 80s-ish, while you're at Winona Court and while you're at the townhouse that you guys ended up living in next, would you say that those are probably your favorite times of your life?
Well, probably some of my favorite, but I don't think Jenny would think they were too much of a favorite. I wasn't the very best of husbands at that time or the very best of a father. I was missing a lot of their activities in the later years, and took me a while to settle down. I don't know how Miss Jenny put up with me all these years, but thankfully I saw the light somewhere along the way, and I've been on the straight and narrow for 20, 30 years now.
You had some of your best experiences during those times, because I think at least during these times as well, you and your family to Mexico with you to go see your side of the family, mostly your father and his family sort of in that little area.
Yeah. I took Rick and Becky didn't go with me. We went down there, and at that time they still didn't have any electricity in his village. It was a little town called Jesus Maria Jalisco. It was by the town of Arandas, where it was famous for tequila, and they actually have a town named Tequila, Jalisco. My dad used to raise hogs, and I used to get the impression that they had just mud and muddy pens and all that stuff. But when we got there to see them, they had cement slabs, and he had a kid come down every day and hose down the slabs and hose all the manure and stuff down. The only problem is that all that stuff was going down in the ground, and they had wells that they used for drinking water, and I'm sure all that pollution seeped down into those wells. That's why you don't drink the water. We were pretty lucky not to get sick on that trip.
How many times did you guys end up taking a trip to Mexico to go see your family?
We went twice, and one time we went with my dad. We drove from Denver all the way to Guadalajara, and from there we took a plane, Jenny's first plane ride, to Mexico City. And my dad was able to show us around because for some reason he had been there before. And we got to see the floating gardens, Xochimilco, and went to the pyramids, Teotihuacan, and we were introduced to the green tunas. The tuna is a fruit from the cactus. Usually I have red ones, but out there they had some green ones that were very sweet. We were able to tour the places in Mexico City, the Palacio of Bellas Artes, where we saw the Mexican dance troupe that my nephew Leonard ended up dancing with at the Palacio de Bellas Artes. And it was a very pleasant trip.
You guys had ended up taking probably quite a few trips to Mexico. Last time we had our family from California, and they used to joke that you guys, even when you would end up in California, you'd pop down to Tijuana to have some fun.
The one thing that we done, we went to Mexico specifically to be the godfather to one of our friends, Santos, and we were going to stand up for his daughter. And during the celebration and my drinking and my boasting, I told everybody, well, next time it's going to be for my daughter, and it's going to be in Denver, and I want you all there. So I put that out of my mind. Probably 6 months before Becky's 15th birthday, we got a call from our compadres in Mexico City asking what type of wear we were going to have. If they call them smoke jackets, that's what they refer to it as, tuxedos. And then I told Jenny, you know what, I think they're serious. So we had to start scrambling to put together a quinceañera. I had to go borrow about $5,000, which in that time was a lot of money. But it all turned out pretty good. Becky didn't want it. I said, you will have it, and you will have a good time. But it all turned out pretty good. We had mariachis, and we had a regular band, and we had people from California, Mexico, Nebraska, so it was a pretty big deal, and it all worked out pretty nice.
There's been stories, and I think one of your favorite or least favorite part was you had so many kids in your house for the quinceañera, and some of them just did not want to leave.
That's right. We had seven of the boys. They were the partners of the girls that were going to be in the quinceañera. They stayed with us for 4 days. I had to get up every morning. I was making bacon, potatoes, eggs, and they were eating like hungry farmers. And anyway, we said, well, once the quinceañera is over, they can go home with their parents. But little did we know, when we got back home, there they all were at our house. So I told them, I'm going to feed you tonight, and you're going home tomorrow.
For you guys, at least during this time and for the rest of your guys' life, it feels like your home, our home, becomes a sanctuary for a lot of different people. I attribute a lot of that to my grandmother and just the way she is, but I think a big piece of that is you as well. I think a lot of people respected you and looked up to you. How did that make you feel, knowing that it was... your home was always a safe space for anyone to come into and have a good time?
Well, we did respond to a lot of our nieces and nephews in pretty serious situations where we had to go get them and bring them home. and keep them overnight. But a lot of the girls, our goddaughters, would come to Jenny for advice and someone to tell their troubles to. Stefan and Renee, they used to spend the weekends with us all the time. Erica was small at that time. We didn't have any bassinets or anything, so we'd put her in a laundry basket or in a dresser drawer. But Renee used to come over a lot, and when they'd have problems, they'd talk to us, and we'd talk to them. And we always had an open house for all the kids, and they knew it, and they felt comfortable coming over there. And it was very flattering for them to have confidence in us. Matter of fact, our kids have brought this up now that they're old and grown, that they took away their parents from them because we spent so much time with the nieces and nephews and godsons and goddaughters.
Yeah, and I don't think it might have been your guys' intent to ever do that or to put my father and aunt in that situation, but I think you guys mean so much to just our family as a whole, just because of what you did there. And unfortunately, everything does come at some sort of cost, but what did it mean to you, or was it ever really your intent to eventually build a household like this? Because I know coming from you, your mom and dad are separated. Your dad was in California growing up for you for most of your life. Your mom was struggling and trying to hustle her way to make the best of the situation. And now that you are the adult in the situation, you build a household like this. Was that your intention or purpose?
No, it wasn't my purpose, because it took me a long time to adjust to Jenny and her family, because I had never been, to my knowledge, I could never remember having a Christmas or Easter or all those holidays, because we didn't celebrate those things. And it took me a long time to get where I was participating with the family. Usually we had a negative vibes. I really didn't feel accepted. To this day, sometimes in the back of my mind, I have a little doubt, and I always say facetiously that I stuck it out with Jenny so I could get Lucy mad, because Lucy was the one that said she didn't want Jenny to marry me, but I was going to show her it was going to work out. But again, like I say, it wasn't just spite. It was the love we grew to have for each other and the respect and consideration we had for each other.
Yeah, and I think you and my grandmother worked out well together, mostly because my grandmother characteristically is very caring, very loving. For her, though, I think her biggest weakness is she's very resistant to trying new things, I think, for the most part. You, however, come from something very different. It feels like, for the most part, your mom and dad were looking after you, but for the most part, you've been taking care of yourself for a lot of your life. But for you, you've been very well sort of experienced and ready to go try new things. So I think you guys kind of fit well together as those pieces, because it feels like you guys are both missing a piece that the other one has. What do you remember, at least, about taking my grandmother on her first trip that's not to Nebraska or that's not to Colorado?
When I retired in 92, I told her I wanted to take a trip up the coast of California, go up to Oregon and Washington, and she just kept ignoring me. So one day I called AAA. Next thing you know, they're showing up with a stack of tour books, tour guide books. And we took off one day, and we went from Denver. We went through Las Vegas and into Pomona, California. My sister Annie was living there, and we spent a couple of days with her. And then we went to headed west to the coast, and we got to Highway 101 and Highway 1, the Pacific Coast Highway. Went up and spent our first evening in Winters, California. It was Fort Bragg, California, or Fayetteville, California. And I didn't know that there was the same name town that they had in North Carolina. But anyway, we got to see the ocean. We had a nice little cottage, and we had little fire, a bonfire in the back there. And from there we went up. We took a train into the Redwood Forest and seen all these magnificent trees and stuff. And I told Jenny, I says, I want to drive through that giant redwood that you can drive your car through. So we done that. Went up the coast to Oregon and went down in an elevator down to the caves where the seals would live, and that's where they made it, and it stunk terribly down there, but it was very interesting. And from there we went up to Washington, and we went to Olympia, Washington, where they have a brewery there, and they have a river that comes down, and we saw them taking the salmon out of there and putting them in these cannery tanks where they would separate the male from the female. The females, they would milk them for their eggs, and the males, they would kill them and send them to the cannery. It was a very enjoyable trip, and on these trips, we managed to even get closer by just enjoying the same things and new things that we'd never seen before, and things that she would have never seen if she would have never left Nebraska.
At least for you, did you ever find it difficult or hard to try and go and experience something new? Mostly because, like I said, my grandmother is very stubborn, and she does not like many new things in general, unless you just kind of sign her up and throw her into the water just to see how it goes. How was all of that for you guys, particularly while you've been married and going on these trips, like first flight?
One of the things that we seen in Seattle was we were taking a launch over to this island where the indigenous Indians were, the Native Americans. And when we got off the launch, they were handing people a cup of clam soup. And Jenny says, no, I don't like clam soup. I didn't know that I liked it either, but I tasted it, and it was delicious. So I told her, taste this. So she finally did, and she liked it too. So those are a couple of things that, and she would hesitate to do things, to go on trips. Like I would make it a point to plan a big vacation, max out the credit card, and then come back, pay it off, and do another one. And that's how we went to Hawaii. We were lucky enough to go for 21 days, and it seemed like overnight it went by so quick. And like I say, we grew so close together, just watching the sunset and walking on the beach, and I was able to smoke a cigar on the beach and went to the luau's. But again, it brought us closer and closer.
As we start to come to the end of this episode here, I think I'd be remiss to not talk about your career at the U.S. Post Office, at least for your early to mid-life there. Of course, you said being a mail handler is probably your favorite job that you've ever had, and mail carrier you've had and done. What were some of your favorite experiences from that U.S. Post Office life that you had?
Well, I started off as a part-time janitor, mail handler. I'd work 4 hours as a janitor, 4 hours as a mail handler to get my 8 hours. Then I made full-time mail handler, and then from there I went to carry mail. I carried mail for 14 years. I was my own mailman for 9 years. And I had the kids at school on my route. Every now and then I'd catch Mr. Rick running around and running away from the school, and I'd stop him. He didn't know where I was showing up at. And I said, where are you going? And he said, oh, I was just getting some exercise. or I'd go in the cafeteria and he's sitting against the wall. I said, how come you're sitting against the wall? He said they didn't have enough seats. And that's the kind of wise guy he was. And me, I was just as dumb. I believed him. I didn't know he was being punished. But I carried mail for 14 years, which I really thoroughly enjoyed. I met a lot of people, good people, and enjoyed experiences like this one route I had. Had these golden, delicious apple trees. And every fall, I would fill up my satchel with them, and they were crunchy and sweet. And I've never tasted an apple that tasted that good anymore after that. Then I decided to get into management, which was, on my part, I was looking to get ahead and better myself. But I got into a worse situation because there was a lot of politics played in the upper part of management. And if you didn't play the game, you weren't going to get promoted or move up. The stress got so bad that I had to go to a head doctor for about a month. And then there was talk about an early out. And I was asking Jenny, I says, I don't know if we can afford it. So we decided that peace of mind was better than finances. So I went ahead and when they came up with a early out in 92, I went ahead and took it. And it was the best thing I ever done, but I did lose 6% of my retirement. It hurt a little bit, but then I start working part-time jobs in labor pool jobs, stores. Like the one company I worked for was named the job store. And I start working at Continental Airlines the month after I retired. Jenny says, hey, they're hiring at Continental. Why don't you go see if you can get on? And dummy me, I went and I got on. But you had to go to 2 weeks of training, learning how to identify the different planes and where their hatch doors were and how to load them and how to put chemicals together and what not to put together. And then the 2 weeks of training, you didn't get paid anything. So if you didn't pass the training, you didn't get hired on. But I passed and naturally got hired on working in the baggage room. And that's where all the bags come from. And then you put them on the carts of the planes that they're supposed to go on. From the baggage room, I got to get out on one of the flight crews and you're assigned a gate. You had a certain responsibility. When the planes came in on your certain gate, you had to unload everything and then load it back up again. And then they had to clean the plane while you're doing all this and fuel it. You were expected to do all this in a certain length of time. So then the other one was I had to work an evening shift, and I had a contract. We had a contract with Aviones Mexican Airlines, and we had them twice a week. They'd come in from Cancun. We'd have to learn about customs. We'd have to take the stuff through customs. And there was times that we had to open packages. If the customs officer thought there might be some contraband in there, we had to open them. And then after they inspected them, we had to close them back up. And then from there, I didn't go make the move from Stapleton to DIA because that would have been a 34-mile trip. So then I start working for the job store, got me a job at the Air Force Finance Center. I was started off in the mailroom. And then from the mailroom, they decided to make a payroll specialist out of me. So when I found out what procedures I had to do to do a payroll, it took me one day, 8 hours, just to do one. I said, I'm never going to get this. Next thing you know, I'm doing 15, 16 a day, and my coworkers are asking me, how are you able to get all these done so quick? I said, well, I stay at my station and do my work and don't take a, because they'd come in the morning, go to the cafeteria, and this is all after they punch in. And they'd go have their breakfast or bring their breakfast to the desk, and then they'd go to lunch and do their 15-minute break. So I would adhere to the time frames and just do my work. And I got pretty good at being a payroll specialist. And that's about the time I got sick with cancer in 2006. But that's probably for another time.
Out of all your experiences, particularly, and we've talked about the notable jobs, I still think you would say mail carrying is your favorite. Being a mail carrier, particularly at that time in the 60s, 70s, 80s-ish, very friendly role. What did you like the most about it? Because it's not an easy job. You have to walk around, be on your feet a lot. You have to go through rain, wind, snow, hail, whatever it is. What made you keep doing that?
It was the people contact. You met nice people. You always had the jerk or two, you know. But you just overlooked. You had more nice people than you did bad people. You had nicer weather, more nice weather than you did bad weather, you know. But it was part of the job, and it kept you healthy, you know. I kept the same routes for a long time until I ended up downtown in the main post office. Then I ended up getting a route where I used to live over on 31st and Lawrence. And at that time, after they tore down our house, they built projects there. But I had part of the projects, and then I had part of the business district down Larmer Street where all the bars were up to 20th. And for Christmas, everybody give you a bottle, and I had so many bottles, it wasn't funny. My satchel would be clanging. I had so many bottles. But again, there were nice folks. The businesses would give you gift certificates and stuff like that. So I had run-ins with people I'd gone to school with. They still lived in the neighborhood, and that was a surprise, but it was a pleasant surprise.
You spent the most time at the U.S. Post Office. What about that environment made you feel like this was the place? Because you did a lot of jobs. Of course, you were in the military, which I'm kind of counting as a career, a job as its own. Worked in hospitals. I think you worked in a steel mill at some point.
Yeah, I forgot about that one. When I quit the post office for a short period of time, and then I got a job. My brother-in-law, Abe, used to work at American Breakthrough, which was a foundry, and that pour steel and stuff. And I started as a laborer. After a while, there was an opening for an apprentice crane operator, and the crane operators would take the vats of molten steel and pour them into the molds. So I done a few months of apprentice, and then I got a journeyman's title on a 5 and 10 ton crane. And most of the molders would call for me to turn over their molds, because we used to have big giant molds, these mine grinders that they would they'd call 100-foot round molds, and they would take 8 hours to form that mold and tap the sand in and all that stuff. And then you had to turn the mold over upside down, and if you didn't do it right, all the sand and all that stuff would come out, and then you'd blow the whole thing, and you'd have to start all over again. So evidently I had the finesse to do it just right and flip them over, and I never did have one come apart on me. And then I also used to have to pour the heats with about 20 tons of molten steel, and that was pretty hot. But after that, a lot of the guys that stayed there a long time had black lung disease from the powder from the steel mills.
Again, you've done a lot of crazy and different jobs. Most of them for a couple of years here and there. You spent the most, like I said, the most time at the post office. What made you say that this is the sort of the place for you? I guess was it the environment, the friendly people? For you, I'd say you like to be outside more often than not. Was it that you got to go to kind of walk around the neighborhoods? What made you say, I want to be here? Because even after you left, you said, I got to go back.
Well, the first thing was that I needed a stable job because I had a family to support. I said, well, I can't be bouncing around. So I decided to make that my career. I had no intentions of going into management, but I carried mail, and then they passed the peacetime GI veterans plan where you could go to college. And I was going to Red Rocks Community College taking business management. I took 2 years of that, and then that's when I decided, I guess I better try to improve myself, which I started as a delivery supervisor. And I ended up on the docks at the terminal annex where we were in charge of the mail coming in and the mail going out. The mail trucks would come in and bring the daily collections from all over the city. And we put them dump sacks and put them on conveyor belts. And they'd go up to the machines. And then we, at that time, we still had trains to unload. The second class and third class bulk mail would come on the train and in trucks. So we had the trains come in. And they all came at the same time. Off the trains, they used to have railroad clerks for the post office. And when they phased out the railroad clerks at the post on the railroad trains, they brought them over to be clerking at the post office, so they blended right in with the regular clerks. And we always had something to do. So like I say, I decided I'd try to improve myself. And then I got promoted to a station superintendent and was sent out to a delivery units. I worked at Belmar. I worked at Highlands Station that was on 32nd and Federal. I worked at Cap Hill. I worked at Main Office. I retired from Cap Hill Station, which we had all the downtown area naturally in the Capitol and all the government offices.
Looking back on your life, at least this piece of your life now when you're of this age, what does it make you think? What does it make you feel? Particularly because you're coming from a kid who was shining shoes, selling papers, just trying to get by. You ended up in the military almost by necessity to sort of clean your act up. Now, at least up to this point of this, your story in the life, you have this family, you have this community around you, even though that you sometimes you feel and have a doubt that they don't care. They really do care about you, and they love you, and they support you. What does that make you feel now, sort of looking back at you?
Well, I thank God for everything he gave me, because never in my wildest dreams did I think I'd ever go to the places I saw or do the things I did. There was one time we were in Washington, D.C. We're in the limo drinking Bloody Marys, and I had the opportunity to be on a committee that we were going to make the first on-site child care center, and we had to do all the research, but we had to go present our our program and our findings to the Postmaster General in Washington, D.C. So we had to go down there. We had a representative from each labor union, and I was the management representative. And we each had a turn to make our presentation to Postmaster General. And we done good enough, so we got approved, and we were funded, and we had the first on-site daycare center for children at the General Mail facility in Commerce City. The employees could take their children there and drop them off and go into work, and that was the best situation they could have. But then they abused it. They start leaving the workroom floor, and then when they'd inquire where they were, they'd say that they were checking on their kids at the childcare center. So they had to start putting in sign-ins for them to do that. And then they would, on paydays, they would go cash their checks, because we had a bar close by, and they'd forget about their children, and they'd come try to pick them up when they'd been drinking, and then they wouldn't let them release them unless they had a sober person with them. And after I left the Postal Service, I found out that they eventually closed it, and which it was a shame, because it was a situation that everybody else that worked in different situations would have loved to have and would have appreciated it. But I was sorry to hear that they closed it. But again, like I say, I could have died 20 years ago and still been happy, because I've done more in my life than I could ever remember. And to set the record straight, I'm pretty good with the family now. We've grown pretty close, and I guess bygones be bygones.
I don't think anyone in our family has any animosity or has any dislike for you. They love you very much. Even my Aunt Lucy, who didn't want the first thing to begin with, I think she loves you dearly. You and my grandmother go check on her, take her to places where she needs to be. I think you've done more than enough to prove that you fit in with the family as a whole, and just as the person that you are. I think there are a lot of people who would thank you for who they are and helping them out in the situations that they may or may not talk about with the other family that you guys know about. I think at least from your time with the family, through Winona, through all that you've been through, at least in your midlife, we'll basically call it, from military on out, you made an impact on a lot of different people's lives. And I don't know if you're aware of that or have really thought about it that way. So just from them, I will thank you myself, because next episode we'll talk about life comes at you fast sometimes. And not only did you allude to that you got diagnosed with cancer, but you also end up having to be a father again and take care of me and my brother. But we'll save that for the next one. The last question for you before we wrap up this whole thing. I know we talked about it a lot. Family, doing a lot of work from your midlife here, we'll say getting out of the military up to moving to 50, 60. What are you most proud of, or what makes you the most happy about that time?
The most proud of was, like I say, with Jenny putting up with me and us being together all these years, and seeing my children grow up and have families of their own, and being able to assist where I can and do what I can to help bring up the rest of the family. And I know somewhere along the line there's a few young men that I have spoken to that I set them on the straight and narrow just by telling them my experiences and what you didn't want to do. But like I say, never in my wildest dream thinking I'm going to live this long and still enjoy my being a senior in my senior years, I hope to go as far as I can, or as long as I can, as long as I'm of a sound mind, and I always kid around that I can change my own diaper.
I think that's a perfect wrap to this episode. Like I talked about, or like I've alluded to last question, going to be a part three to this guy. We'll sort of wrap up your story here. You do end up eventually getting cancer, of course, which no one wants. And then on top of that, you are also having to take care of me and my brother and be a guardian and a father there again, which is, I think, rough because we're coming to you guys after you've retired. You guys are in your early 60s. You guys are kind of supposed to be twilighting, traveling, and just sort of enjoying life. But now you have to be a whole father and do this whole ordeal again of being a family guy, and instead of kind of taking your relaxation and doing all the fun things that retired people should be doing. Eventually you will get to fully retire and you get to spend your time here in your retirement home with your tiny dog and still my grandmother on a day-to-day, growing closer each day, of course. So we'll talk about that next time. Thank you again for listening. Of course, my grandfather will be back for one more episode to finish up his story, his life journey here. I can't thank you guys enough for listening and keeping up with this. If you didn't listen to the last episode, I strongly suggest that. I think there's some good tips in that from my grandfather. This is middle life, so of course we're going to finish up with the last piece of his life and get to where we are today. With that, hope you keep listening, and hope you enjoy this journey.